Welcome back to the Far Middle Podcast. This is episode 8. I am Nick Deolius. You can follow me on Twitter at Nick Deolius. You can also check out the website, nickdeolius.com, when you've got a few minutes to peruse it and see what's updated with commentary and new news. And then, of course, a new chapter posting of my upcoming book, The Leech, each week that will be the day after we post a Far Middle Podcast. So please check it out when you've got the chance and the time. Today on this version of our Far Middle Podcast, we want to talk about public pension plans and also the people managing and leading the public pension plans. Public pension plans in the United States, why are we talking about them? Well, there's really three reasons. One, they're a big deal. When you look at the size and magnitude of public pension plans, and here we're talking, just to be clear, about pension plans that are there to provide benefits to retirees and to active workers that will become retirees that are state employees, whether they be state government, local government, federal government. These could be teachers, fire, police, clerical workers, everyone in between. When I say they're a big deal, the annual benefit payments to beneficiaries of public pension plans, it comprises roughly 1.5% of U.S. GDP. So that is, again, a very large presence in our economy. Second, public pensions are, unfortunately, today finding themselves increasingly in trouble. Increasingly in trouble from the perspective of the financial health of these funds. Public pension plans across the United States are carrying a $4 trillion shortfall. That's equivalent to the size of the economy of Germany, not a small economy by any measure. So $4 trillion, that is a huge number. That's the shortfall that we're seeing in the aggregate for public pension funds today. And also another way of thinking about that, the situation's getting worse when it comes to financial health of public pensions. Since 2007, the liabilities of public pensions have increased 64%, while the assets have grown only 30%. So that gap of funding and that gap of financial pain is only widening. And then a third reason we're talking about public pensions is, unfortunately, despite them being a massive component of our economy, and despite them being increasingly in financial duress or trouble, the leaders, the managers of certain public pension funds have lost their fiduciary compass. And worse yet, not only have they lost or have they broken their fiduciary compass, they've replaced it with, or it's being overridden by, the leech way in many instances that we'll discuss. Well, what is the fiduciary duty or responsibility of a pension fund manager? You can look to something like the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, what we commonly refer to as ERISA, for some guidance, because ERISA is quite direct as to the role and responsibility of pension fund managers. ERISA states that the responsibility of those managers is to manage the plan solely in the interest of participants and beneficiaries and for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits and paying plan expenses. That's pretty direct. That's pretty straightforward. Exclusive purpose, provide benefits, pay your plan expenses, and you're there solely to look after the interests of the participants and the beneficiaries of that pension. Now, you compare that statement of fiduciary duty from ERISA, and whether you want to apply that to a private pension plan that you would see in corporate America, which is largely followed by those managers, or you want to superimpose it on a similar type of fiduciary for a public pension plan, you often see when you get to the public pension fund manager not following that guideline or those guideposts laid out by ERISA. You see something very different. What do you see that's different? Well, instead, what you see are, in certain instances, in some of these, the largest public pension plans in the land, you see these managers and leaders who are, for lack of a better term, starved for a cause. And those causes can be a range of different issues in total, or they could be individual discrete issues. It really depends on which pension plan and which individual manager or leader you're assessing. But nevertheless, more and more, you see this issue where the pension fund managers are using the public pension plans to pursue certain ideologies or certain political agendas instead of focusing on those primary and exclusive duties that ERISA lays out. So the era when the pension fund manager was expected to be a couple things. One, expected to be honest, expected to make money for the beneficiaries, expected at certain times, maybe perhaps in good years, to beat the market, because of its financial or their financial acumen, and also to avoid big losses, right? You didn't want a massive loss taken by the pension that would put at risk a lot of the benefits for the retirees and the active workers who would ultimately want to become retirees. That's sort of the guidelines you would lay out for your ideal pension fund manager on a public pension side not long ago. But today, what you see, again, in instances that are growing in magnitude, you see fund managers and leaders of public pension funds that are more interested, instead of those things, of pursuing societal change. And when you start to pursue societal change, it creates an opportunity, an environment where you can not just make performance worse when it comes to the financials of the public pension plan, but you can also obfuscate or cloud what's going on with respect to those more pressing financial issues in terms of being able to provide benefits and having assets to cover promises and liabilities. Where you see public pension plan managers drive toward pushing political agendas or pushing for certain societal changes instead of focusing on the financial health of the fund and being able to provide benefits to retirees, one of the most popular mechanisms or vehicles to pursue that desire instead of what your fiduciary duty is with ESG, or environmental social governance investing, ESG investing, right? Doing well by doing good, or whatever popular tagline you want to attach to it. ESG investing has just been taken on by certain public pension plans and its managers, and then just basically put on steroids or turbocharged to pursue these other types of agendas in very big ways. And we've spoken quite a bit about ESG investing, sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly of it, to quote a famous movie title. And we've written on that with the website nickdeolias.com under the commentary section. You can give that that essay a read about ESG investing. And of course, it is also front and center in the upcoming book, The Leech, when it comes to not just public pension plans and how certain plans and their managers have lost their fiduciary compass, but also with respect to just financial investing in the markets overall. My concerns and the issues that the wider economy and society should have with ESG investing really fall across three distinct buckets or criticisms. One, ESG investing as it's currently practiced today is largely a very, very subjective exercise. What do I mean by that? Well, what is socially just? What is good governance? What is environmentally friendly? What are those things, and what constitute those practices? Oftentimes is very much in the eye of the beholder. Depends on who you're talking to and what type of filters or criteria you wish to apply. And an example I'll give you would be something like a fossil fuel company in an industry that I work in. My view, and I think my view is based on reason and fact and ration, being rational, is that a fossil fuel producer who is responsible, let's say in the natural gas industry within the United States, is a much more socially conscious, better ESG investment vehicle than something, let's say, than a soft drink manufacturer, some of them quite well known and quite large, because the soft drink manufacturer is basically selling or peddling obesity and poor health and diabetes and non-wellness, whereas the natural gas producer is selling energy independence and affordable energy and getting energy access to the masses of poor across the globe who would drastically improve their station in life and life expectancies. I think a natural gas producer or a fossil fuel producer in the United States is a more worthy investment from a socially conscious perspective than something like a fast food chain, some of them quite large and very well known. Similar reasons from the soft drink manufacturer, pushing or selling obesity, non-wellness, and making the health condition of its customer worse, and trying to push that through a very focused and intense advertising campaign to have them consume more of those types of food products that are bad for the individual, in some instances bad for the kid, because that's one of the key markets of maybe many fast food chains in terms of their customer base, versus what the natural gas producer or fossil fuel energy company is providing to society. So very subjective when you start looking at what's worthy, what's not worthy, what's just, what's not just. And that subjectivity creates an awful lot of opportunity for very wide discrepancies and almost a very random approach to what gets into certain ESG vehicles or investments or indices and what is excluded. The second concern that I've got with ESG investing, at least as it's currently practiced, is that in many instances, you do not see in the data, in the actual objective data, outperformance of ESG-focused funds or investment vehicles versus just your standard index funds or weightings of different types of industries or indices. Now, at first blush, that sort of makes sense to me, because when you go toward ESG investing, when you start to exclude an investment class from consideration in a portfolio because of what would be, in some instances, purely subjective criteria, well, it's not a stretch to assume or conclude that that's going to hurt returns or increase risk or a combination of the two. And the data show this. So it depends on which data you look at. I can show you data where ESG-focused investment vehicles outperform, but I can also show you a slew of data where they don't. So the waters are definitely muddied at the least. I've seen data where average annual returns in states with their pension plans that are applying politically correct investment programs were lower by about 0.4 percentage points, which doesn't sound like much, but is quite a bit, especially when you consider the precarious financial position that a lot of these public pension plans find themselves in, but were 0.4 percentage points lower than states that weren't handcuffed with these divestment requirements. I've seen data where public companies in both energy and tech sectors, which are two very popular industries where ESG investing is implied or ESG filters are applied, but there have been periods of time where these public companies in those two sectors show no correlation of company share price performance to their ESG weightings, whether that was overweighted or underweighted on the ESG spectrum. And also, on average, ESG funds underperformed the S&P 500 for significant periods of time. So the data can be quite negative and a minimum, very convoluted or cloudy when it comes to trying to establish how ESG filters and ESG performance pays off with a premium return over the long haul and on a consistent basis. The data being cloudy at best, if not very questionable on the suspect approaches that some use for ESG investing, including public pension plans, shouldn't be all that surprising. I'm infamous for applying sports analogies probably much too often, but think of it from this perspective. If you suddenly said, if you were the owner or the manager of a baseball team in the major leagues, and you suddenly said, because of purely subjective criteria, I am now going to make the determination that I will never adopt or employ or put on the mound a left-handed pitcher, because left-handers are just inherently bad in terms of the type of player that they are. Well, at some point, if you would limit yourself and then your competition, the other teams were not limiting themselves with that subjective criteria. They were perfectly fine with left-handed pitchers. In fact, what they were doing instead was, out of five left-handed pitching prospects, they were assessing through hard work and sweat who the best one was of the five and who the poorest performer was of the five. And they chose the best one and for the opportunity to put the bad pitcher on the mound. They are going to quickly run up in the standings, and you with your team without your left-handed pitching is going to fall in the standings. And that's what you would expect. It's the same with investing if you're being purely subjective on ESG filters and not doing the tough day-to-day work and screening and analysis to pick out the best in breed with respect to certain industries, instead of avoiding or barring or divesting an entire industry just because of its nature. Now, you see this too with some really interesting data and results. One I saw recently was year-to-date through early June of 2021, a gun fund. This was a fund that was put together of gun manufacturers. I'm not sure who put that together, but the gun fund basically outperformed the S&P as of early June 2021. I think the gun fund was up 16.5% as of early June, and the S&P was up just under 10%, 9.9%, which is a significant outperformance, 16.5% versus 9.9%. Almost an anti-ESG outperformance of a certain index of companies. And you also see this when it comes to, ironically, the actual environmental performance of a lot of these ESG-worthy companies or ESG-focused funds. I saw data recently about the S&P Global Clean Energy Index versus just the S&P 500. So the S&P Global Clean Energy Index is an ESG-focused index exclusively constructed, selecting companies that are scoring great on these somewhat subjective criteria on the environmental spectrum. Well, if you look at the carbon emitted per dollar invested and the carbon emitted per dollar of revenue of the S&P Global Clean Energy Index versus the S&P 500, guess which one is doing worse on that carbon emitted ratio or pair of ratios? Ironically, it's the S&P Global Clean Energy Index. It's got higher carbon emissions per dollar of revenue or dollar invested than the S&P 500 does, which again shows you some of the counterintuitive results, the unintended consequences of what you get when you start embracing and pursuing ESG investing or these ESG indices or indexes without thinking through and doing the tough work that it takes to really accurately assess what environmental, social, and governance effective performance represents. Now, unfortunately, the reality of ESG investing when it's applied in a sort of blind fashion without doing the hard work and the tough analytics that are required to do it correctly, ESG investing, it's not a guarantee for outperformance financially for public pension plans or investors. And it can be a tax on the unwitting retiree and active worker who's contributing into that pension plan, where they're sitting there thinking that their benefits are going to be fully funded and waiting for them because their pension managers are making astute financial decisions and doing the astute assessments and analyses that are required to get acceptable returns. But instead, again, these pension fund managers in some instances are pursuing political agendas and looking for catalyzing change societally, and they're not doing the work that's necessary. Instead, they're using ESG investing as a convenient tactic, sort of a blunt instrument to pursue those other objectives that are very different than what the fiduciary duty would be of a public pension plan manager. By the way, to be fair, this issue of ESG being used as a blunt instrument, a tactic to pursue political agendas or create certain images or veneers with public pensions or certain public pension plans, it is not unique to that space. Unfortunately, you see this occurring just as often and just as large of a scale with publicly traded corporations and companies across a whole range of industries. I've written extensively about this on nickdeolias.com and throughout different speeches and presentations that you can see at the website. But the best example of this is the demise of Pacific Gas and Electric, the very large utility in Northern California, and how their pursuits of this ESG obsession and putting the form in front of the substance of a strong and resilient grid and astute financial investment decisions resulted in not just financial ruin for its shareholders through bankruptcy, but more importantly, just a human tragedy of a really large scale with dozens and dozens of fatalities that were caused by wildfires, which were caused by a dilapidated grid. So you have an example of Pacific Gas and Electric, where they were being awarded all kinds of ESG accolades and prizes and plaques, and they were pursuing and throwing billions of dollars into all kinds of environmentally friendly or politically correct types of programs, instead of investing those dollars into just good old-fashioned maintenance and grid resiliency when it came to transmission lines and towers and generating capacity. And what happened was, when it got windy one day in Northern California, a 90-plus-year-old hook that was not replaced on a major transmission line broke, and that transmission line fell to the ground, sparked, and created a fire with some brush that was very dry, and the wind coupled with that fire that was started by the transmission line that fell because of a failed 90-plus-year-old hook created an epic wildfire that killed, as I said, dozens of people and destroyed countless numbers of homes and scorched acres. So Pacific Gas and Electric is probably the biggest, most pertinent example. And by the way, the ramifications of that go way beyond the death toll of the wildfires and way beyond the investors, in many instances, public pension plans being wiped out through the bankruptcy. It also carries on to this day. It's one of the biggest reasons why wide swaths of California are experiencing rolling blackouts whenever it gets very hot, or whenever the wind starts to blow in a strong fashion. You see rolling blackouts because the grid is so dilapidated because of pursuing these ESG shiny types of objectives and accolades instead of investing into the bricks and mortar and the nuts and bolts of the infrastructure, that it will take years for an entity like Pacific Gas and Electric to get the grid to the point where it can actually perform when it's windy or deliver power when it's hot. My last major concern with ESG investing, at least as it's applied today, really speaks to what the cost is of these ESG products. We talked about how ESG products in many instances with certain data sets do not outperform. Frankly, they underperform just run-of-the-mill indexes or indices that are much lower cost. But that cost component tied to ESG funds, they're very expensive investment vehicles. You pay for the ability of some fund manager to do the filtering of what is a worthy investment and what is a not worthy investment to create the ESG portfolio. And if public pension plans and their managers are pursuing these and paying above market fees for these types of products, and you're not seeing outperformance, and you're in some instances not even seeing performance with the lower cost investment options that are not ESG focused, then something has to give, and questions should be raised for an accounting of why that is occurring. But as ESG popularity explodes, there is a growing risk of questionable marketing and presentations of ESG products by the financial services industry. Maybe that shouldn't be a shock to us. We've seen this time and time again in things beyond ESG in the ESG arena. But nevertheless, I think we're seeing that today when it comes to environmental, social, and governance type products. You see an array of funds with all kinds of different titles today. You see key terms in those titles like responsible and sustainable and green and ethical, environment, right? You know the words well by now. And they just continue to grow at an explosive exponential rate. And when you look at the reality of these ESG funds or supposed ESG funds, they're simply run-of-the-mill mutual funds. They look no different from a portfolio makeup or a portfolio weighting than your run-of-the-mill lower-cost mutual fund would be. So there is, unfortunately, I believe, a growing incident of a host of financial services companies that are rolling out ESG-friendly titled funds that have really no meaningful difference in their holdings compared to the non-ESG mutual funds. And those investors or those public pension fund managers that have some sort of guilt-ridden urge or just a political interest in pursuing the sort of doing well by doing good type of vehicles, in some ways they're becoming duped or conned into a multi-billion dollar, maybe multi-hundreds of billions of dollars charade of nothing more than wordsmithing in certain instances. Maybe not surprisingly, definitely sad, but if you've got a public pension plan, and the leadership of that plan is focused primarily on pursuing politically favored agendas or pushing for maybe noble societal change that is good, but not in the fiduciary wheelhouse, so to speak, of the pension plan leadership. It's not surprising, but it is sad that you don't just see financial performance suffering, which will harm retirees and active workers that are working for government. But in many instances, you will then see this lack of attention on managing your wider team within the public pension plan. And these are institutions, remember, that are moving and investing billions upon billions of dollars. So you've got massive amounts of money where you've got subjectivity and decision-making that needs to be applied in judgment by different portfolio managers and financial experts within the public pension plan. And if you're not paying attention to the governance and the internal controls, making sure that those employees are ethical and making decisions in the best interests of the beneficiaries of the public pension plan, there's going to be the opportunity for wrongdoing because the environment will allow for it. And unfortunately, there are always going to be certain individuals, obviously in a minority of the total team, but nevertheless, it only takes one that will be willing to take advantage of that lack of oversight and that lack of intense management. And we've seen that across a number of public pension plans, some of them the largest public pension plans in the nation. We've seen them on the East Coast in New York State, New York City area. We've seen them on the West Coast with California. We talk about a couple of those examples in the book, The Leech, in that chapter on public pension plans. And once again, what caused this? It's the lack of leadership in those instances. It's not staying true to your fiduciary duty of returns and providing benefits to your beneficiaries of retirees and active workers. It's being distracted by pursuing these other agendas, whether they are noble endeavors or not, but not being the job of the public pension fund or its leadership, and then, you know, getting distracted and allowing someone or a group of individuals to take advantage of that and start to take liberties to embezzle money or to steal money from the pension plan and its beneficiaries. So unfortunately, that is one of the natural expectations and byproducts of what you will see when these types of dynamics come to root. Not only does the likelihood of wrongdoing with certain individuals within these public pension plans go up when you become distracted on the leadership level of the plans themselves, but you also see a really interesting dynamic that I find interesting, perhaps, that is really buried within the details of how pensions report the financial health of their assets, their liabilities, the gap between the two on an ongoing basis. And this gets into financial math and actuarial science, which are typically viewed as really boring areas by most of us. But I got to tell you, the more that I've dug into this, it's become much more of a fascinating issue to me, because there's really two assumptions in the actuarial projections of the health of a pension that drive probably 90% of the health of the pension and whether it's in great shape, poor shape, or facing insolvency. And those two factors are the discount rate that you're assuming and the return on assets. Now, the discount rate, for those of you that aren't familiar with finance, that's a method that's used to express all the future liability of the fund. And it's in the form of checks you're making to retirees and the beneficiaries. And it looks at those future liabilities and outlays that you're going to make payments from the current year on out into the future. And it uses a discount rate to bring it back to a present value single sum total, single number. So the discount rate sets the present value, the cumulative amount owed by the fund. And the lower the discount rate is, the larger the present value of the liability, all other things being equal. So lower discount rate, bigger liability, bigger challenge. Return on assets, the second key assumption, that's what the fund is going to assume on average that the assets in the pension are going to earn into the future. So the lower the return on assets, the larger a fund's deficit is going to be, because you have less assets to cover your future promises, your future outlays. So discount rate sort of sets the present value of the future bill in a current single day number. And the return on assets assumes how much you're going to have to be able to pull from to pay for future promises and payments into the future. So the higher the return on assets, the better shape the pension's in. The higher the discount rate, the better shape the pension's going to be in. And the converse is true. The lower for those two, the tougher the road is going to be. What's happening with particularly return on assets is a pretty ugly situation for all pensions, including public pension plans. And what you've got going on here is that the assets assumed returns, which typically used to be a non-controversial issue and would hover somewhere between 7 and 9% annually, and it's still in that sort of 6 to 8% range for most pension plans. That was non-controversial because it was quite easy to meet that. Back in the day when we had normal interest rates set by the Federal Reserve to reflect the value of money, that return on asset level that you were assuming, it was close to the risk-free rate for a 30-year treasury bond, which is a very low-risk investment vehicle. So that was a happy time for pensions. Hitting a good return on asset number was easy and pretty certain. But when the Fed decided, for a whole bunch of reasons that we discussed in our prior podcast, most of them not good reasons, decided to make money free and cut interest rates to zero or negative on an inflation-adjusted real basis, then the ability to get a return on asset level that is somewhere in the 6, 7, 8, or 9% level on an annual basis is evaporated. Because if you look, and we're all familiar with this, savings accounts pay zero, money markets pay zero, debt instruments, bonds, and corporations or government vehicles are very low yields. And on top of it, because everybody's rushing for return and those types of avenues that I just mentioned don't offer any sort of return, the bubble type pricing that you see in the stock market, in real estate, in alternative investments, in private equity, right? They just keep going up and up and up. And thus the ability to get sustainable returns to offset those negative to zero to very low returns of your safer vehicles, it gets tougher and tougher and tougher, and frankly, riskier and riskier and riskier. And to make matters worse, there was also coincidental and alongside concurrent with what was going on with returns because of zero interest rates from the Fed and what that did to return on assets, there was also this dynamic going on with demographics. And you were seeing a shift in the demographics of many public pension plans, specifically in the ratio of active workers that are injecting assets into the plans, making contributions into them, versus the retired workers who are pulling out assets via retiree checks. So obviously for the health of a pension plan, you want as many active workers as you can relative to your retirees, because that means at some point more money would be coming into the pension than outgoing. And conversely, if that ratio is plummeted, which it has, then you've got a problem where the checks that you're cutting each month or each quarter or each year are exceeding what's being contributed into the pension because you don't have enough active workers. Now, why did those demographics shift? It wasn't just because of an aging and shrinking workforce that you would see in certain sectors or geographic regions of the country that the pensions would be subjected to. The unfavorable shift in this ratio of active to retired workers was accelerated and frankly worsened by politicians and bureaucrats who were looking towards short-sighted votes in elections and influence through political giveaways. So this goes back to the iron triangle that we spoke about that sometimes you see evident with public sector unions, where you've got the bureaucrat and the politician and the public union that are working in close collaboration to the detriment in many instances of active workers and retirees and certainly taxpayers. So you see these negotiated giveaways through contract negotiations with public sector workers and unions. And what are they specifically? They can be a reduction in early retirement age, which will change that active to retired ratio sooner. It can be a reduction in the required years of service to enjoy pension benefits or retiree benefits. And it can be the addition of overtime into pension formulas, which will increase the outlays for a given retiree if and when they retire. So all of those things cumulatively, that's going to push certain public pension plans into cash flow negative territory. We saw that start in the 90s. It accelerated in sort of the first decade of the 2000 era, and it has just gotten bigger and bigger as time has gone on. So it's in many ways short-termism of our political class and our bureaucratic class, the expert class, that's looking supposedly after the health of things like public pension plans. And instead of looking at the long-termism of what's good for the financial health of the pension and thus the retirees and active workers, it instead, those entities got obsessed and got distracted with the short-term gains. And now we've got, unfortunately, a very big long-term problem. When you take these cumulative impacts of the Fed driving interest rates to zero and what that does to discount rate and what that does to hurt return on assets and how those two things hurt the financial health of the public pension plan and these demographic shifts that we spoke about, some of them just through natural progressions, but some of them through poor contracts in terms and conditions tied to those public sector contracts. You add it all up, unfortunately, the situation from a number of different perspectives looks insurmountable when it comes to the health in the aggregate of public pension plans. I saw a study from the Hoover Institute. It's projecting a $3.8 trillion deficit in U.S. state and city public pension plans. That's a massive number for state and public pension plans. The World Economic Forum took this sort of math to a global level. It looked at six of the largest global pension systems in the world. So it looked at the United States, the UK, Japan, Netherlands, Canada, and Australia. Added all six of them up and projected out into a 2050 timeframe. And by 2050, those six countries are going to have a global pension deficit or shortfall of $224 trillion. $224 trillion. that situation is beyond bleak. I also saw a study that that was jointly issued by Stanford along with Erasmus Rotterdam, and it looked at what the return on assets were being assumed by public pension plans, and it came up with a number of 7.6% annually, and that stretched anywhere from 10 to 30 years. If you look at a 7.6% annual return on asset assumption for a pension or for any investment portfolio that's taking a lower risk perspective with its investment decisions, that is ridiculous in a zero interest rate or in some instances of the world, a negative interest rate environment. So to achieve 7.6 on a regular sustainable basis, when things like your debt investments or your fixed income investments are at zero or close to it, and then again, on top of that, asset valuation levels for equities and for alternative investments are at bubble levels, that is an assumption that is very difficult to justify. And if you would change that to a lower, more reasonable return on asset number over the course of a 10 or a 30-year period, guess what? The financial health of many public pension plans goes from very weak or poor or questionable to just outright crisis mode. And that, of course, would precipitate all kinds of questions and demand all kinds of attention from the different stakeholders of these public pension plans as to why the leadership or the management or the political orders are coming to pursue other things, other agendas, whether they be political or environmental or ESG, whatever the case might be, instead of addressing and reforming the health, the precarious health of the public pension plan itself, and perhaps some discussion as to how it got into that precarious position to begin with. It would have some answering to do. And of course, we've seen that in many instances, the bureaucracy and politicians and the stakeholders that are feeding off of the bureaucracy and the politicians, and in some instances, the public unions, the last thing in the world they are going to want to see is an accounting and accountability to be brought into the formula. Before we leave this discussion of the actuarial financial projections of pension financial health, we talked about return on assets. We briefly mentioned discount rate. A really interesting aspect of discount rates that you see with pension math and in pension finance is that public pension plans are not required to follow the same rules for the assumption of a discount rate that private pension plans are required to follow. Many people don't realize that. Private pension plans, so if you're a publicly traded corporation, if you're General Electric, private pension plans have to apply a risk-free rate based on U.S. Treasuries. And again, with the Federal Reserve pummeling interest rates and yields, what you're seeing is a much lower discount rate that's being applied by publicly traded companies that have pension plans. And that means that they are going to be subjected to steep increases in liability, which will trigger substantial funding requirements. These companies must put hundreds of millions of dollars, or in some instances, billions of dollars into their pension plans under formula and under law to make up the shortfall difference or to help close that funding gap because the discount rate went down. So if you look at a time period or two specific examples, just to show this and illustrate this in sort of a stark contrast, General Electric, a very well-known public company, of course, it had a 4.34% discount rate that it was applying at the end of 2018. So 4.34%. And again, that increased compared to where it was historically, that lower discount rate increased GE's funding gap with its pension and likely could have triggered additional funding requirements that it made into the pension plan to bolster its health. By comparison, CalPERS, this is a public pension plan out in California, one of the largest in the nation, CalPERS was applying a 7.375% discount rate, just under 7.4%. for its 2018-2019 fiscal period. So you got GE at 4.34%, CalPERS 7.375%. Two of the largest pensions out there, one private, one public, completely different assumptions on discount rate. And said differently, if you had a mere 1% point reduction in the discount rate for CalPERS, it would add $30 billion to its funding gap, which is equivalent to about $2,600 per California household. So discount rate matters just as much as return on assets does for the health of a public pension plan. And if public pension plans had to apply the same discount rate math or formulas the private pension plans did, you would have a drastic change in the projected warranted health of those public pension plans, CalPERS being an example, but all of them basically being in the same boat. So keep in mind the nuanced world of actuarial science and financial projections and discount rates and return on assets might seem very boring, very obtuse, but it's really important when you want to get to the bottom of the health of a pension, whether it's private or public. And when you start to look at those details, what's going on with public pension plans and its leadership with respect to how they're applying these crucial assumptions to project a certain image of the health of a pension plan, there's quite a bit of shenanigans going on out there. Some of it by design, some of it by sort of the way it's wired. And the sooner that we can change that and get to a more accurate assessment of what the true financial health are of these public pension plans, the better for a whole bunch of stakeholders. Well, now that you, constant listener, have earned your merit badge when it comes to actuarial science and financial calculations with that discussion, let's wrap up this version of the Far Middle podcast with a couple of concluding thoughts. The first one is that today you see with many public pension plans a fundamental hypocrisy that's at play. And what I mean by that is that on one hand, you see slews of public pension plans that are pushing for divestment of fossil fuel companies or divestment of this type of activity or that such and such industry, all under sometimes ESG doctrine or doing right by doing good or the purpose, the moral purpose that you see when it comes to managing and leading public pension plans. So today, unfortunately, in some of the largest public pension plans in the land, if you are not committed to divesting of fossil fuel holdings, or if you are buying a share of stock in Exxon, those things are largely forbidden. But yet, here's where the hypocrisy comes into play. Pensions, many of them, they eagerly finance a much more real current and existential threat than climate change, and that is Chinese Communist Party oppression and militarism. There are hundreds of Chinese public companies that are both listed in the United States, and then there's countless Chinese private companies that U.S. private equity firms own interests in. Sometimes they're controlling interests. And what are these companies doing? Well, of course, it's a whole spectrum of different things. But in a number of those instances, they are helping the communist government imprison millions of Muslims. They're helping the government crack down on people like Hong Kong protesters, democracy protesters. They're helping to build military bases in the South China Sea. They are building and developing surveillance technology that will be used against people, suppression of Chinese citizens. And they are helping to construct all kinds of military arsenal. It could be ballistic missiles to aircraft carriers and anything that you can think of between those two. Now, a pension fund, a public pension fund, a foundation, a college endowment, inevitably, you will see time and time again that they are investing in these entities, sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. And that type of investment is making Chinese aggression possible. But you're not going to find disclosures, mentions, commitments to not invest in these entities from these public pensions and those that are somewhat ESG minded or say they're ESG driven. So, you know, allowing a state public pension plan to take a moral high ground when it comes to something like a domestic company in the fossil fuel industry, say a natural gas company or an oil company, while allowing them to engage and invest and frankly catalyze that type of aggression by the Chinese Communist Party through the rest of its portfolio, that is a hypocrisy that we should not frankly tolerate. The second concluding thought for this version of our Far Middle podcast goes back to our friend Milton Friedman. And he once wrote a paper, I think it was in 1970. The title of it was "The Social Responsibility of Business is to Increase Its Profits." Big believer in that view. That might be counter to the popular thing that you see today with the stakeholder capitalism idea and what you see coming from entities like the Business Roundtable. But nevertheless, Milton Friedman in 1970 did a really nice job summing up what the focus, the primary, in some instances, the exclusive focus of business leadership should be. If you take care of increasing and growing profits, you're going to take care of a whole bunch of other stakeholders, including employees when it comes to compensation and job security, the wider community, the governments with respect to tax base, and so on. But what you saw in corporate America, and you see it today just growing in some instances, is instead of that focus that that Friedman laid out, you see more of what I would call leftist values and political agendas that are being forced upon companies. And investors in those public companies that own shares in them are forced to support those values and those agendas directly or indirectly, whether they want to or not, right? So that's what you see on the corporate side. Well, there's a contemporary theorem, I call it, to Friedman's position on public companies that holds for public pension plan managers. The social responsibility of a pension fund manager, in my view, is to maximize the plan's return on assets and to minimize fund risk for the plan's retirees and current workers. If you start to deviate from that core mission to pursue other agendas, or you want to indulge some interests that you have, that is a failure of fiduciary duty. And that's going to be particularly true when you consider that public workers and those retirees, they're captive to the retirement plan. They can't vote with their feet by leaving the pension like a private investor can by selling a stock. So what's most worrisome is that this failure, it's conscious and it's intended by the pension fund bureaucracy when you look at some of these public pension plans. So let's get this right, because when it comes to public pension plans, a lot of stakeholders are counting on getting it right. You can see the taxpayers, you can see the retirees that put a whole career into public service wanting to have their retirement benefits still there for them into the future. And then you can see the active workers that are paying into these plans. And frankly, you can also see a whole range of investors. If you're buying municipal bonds, or if you're investing in any sort of fixed income that is government type debt, you're also a stakeholder making sure that this comes out and plays out the right way. So the clock's ticking. It's definitely time to reform how we approach and what we expect from public pension plan managers. Well, where'd the time go? Another episode of our Far Middle podcast has come and gone. I hope you've enjoyed this one, but don't be sad that it's over, because we'll be back in touch soon with another exciting episode and another exciting topic to discuss. Until then, take care. Thank you.